Chapter 8. Momim. Kings never lie. They demand the world be mistaken. Kunrayan Proverb. When we truly apprehend the gods, the Nilnameshi sages say, we recognize them not as kings, but as thieves. This is among the wisest of blasphemies, for we always see the king who cheats us, never the thief. Olekaros. Avowals. Autumn, 4111, Year of the Tusk, the Northern Jayunati Steppe. Yersalka of the Utamut awoke with a start. A noise of some kind. The fire was dead, everything was blackness. Rain drummed against the hide walls of his yaksh. One of his wives groaned and fussed with her blankets. Then he heard it again. A tap against the hide entrance.
Ogatha,
he whispered hoarsely. One of his younger sons had ambled off the previous afternoon and had failed to return. They'd assumed that the boy had been caught by the rain, that he would return after it passed. Ogatha had done as much before. Nevertheless, Yersalka was worried. Always wandering, that boy.
Ogi.
Nothing. Another tap. More curious than alarmed, he kicked his legs free, then crept nude to his broadsword. He was certain it was just Ogi playing games, but hard times had fallen upon the Utamot. One never knew. He saw lightning flash through a seam in the conical ceiling. For an instant, the water dripping through seemed quicksilver. The subsequent thunder left his ears ringing. Then another tap. He became tense. He carefully picked his way between his children and wives, paused before the entrance of his yaksh. The boy was mischievous, which was why Yersalka doted on him so, but throwing stones at his father's yaksh in the dead of night? Was that mischief or malice? He worked the pommel of his sword with his hand. He shivered. Outside, chill autumn rain fell down, down, more soundless lightning, followed by air-hammering thunder. He untied the flap, then slowly pulled it to one side with his broadsword. He could see nothing. The whole world seemed to hiss with a pasty sound of rain across mud and puddles. The roar reminded him of Kayuth. He ducked out into the sheeting water, clenched his teeth so they wouldn't chatter. His toes closed about one of the stones in the mud. He knelt, retrieved it, but could see next to nothing. It wasn't a stone, he realized, but a section of jerky or maybe even a piece of wild asparagus. Another flash of lightning. For a moment, all he could do was blink away the brightness. Understanding rumbled in with the thunder. A section of a child's finger. He held a child's severed finger.
Ogi?
Cursing, he threw the finger down and peered wildly through the surrounding darkness. Rage, grief, and terror were all overwhelmed by disbelief. This isn't happening. Incandescent white cracked the sky, and for an instant he saw the entire world, the desolate horizon, the sweep of distant pastures, the surrounding yaksh of his kinsmen, and the lone figure standing not more than a dozen yards away, watching.
Murderer,
Yersalka said numbly.
Murderer.
He heard steps slosh through the mud.
I found your son wandering the steppe,
the hated voice said.
So I've returned him to you.
Something, a cabbage, hit him in the chest. Uncharacteristic panic seized him.
You live,
he sputtered.
I'm so relieved. All of us will be so relieved.
More lightning. And Yersalka saw him like a hulking wraith, as wild and as elemental as thunder and rain.
Something's broken, the voice grated from the darkness. I'll never mend it.
Yersalka howled and flew forward, sweeping his broadsword in a great arc. But iron limbs caught him in the darkness. Something exploded in his face. His sword fell from senseless fingers. A hand throttled him, and he beat at a forearm made of stone. He felt his toes drag grooves through the muck. He gagged, felt something sharp arc above his groin.
There was a steaming rush across his thighs, the uncanny sensation of being gouged hollow. He skidded and slapped into the mud, convulsed about his entrails.
I'm dead.
A brief flutter of white light, and Yersalka saw him crouching above, saw deranged eyes and a famished grin. Then everything went black.
Who am I?
The blackness asked.
Neor, he gasped. Man-killer. Most violent of all men.
A slap, open-handed, as though he were a slave.
No, I am your end. Before your eyes, I will put your seed to the knife. I will quarter your carcass and feed it to the dogs. Your bones I will grind to dust and cast to the winds. I will strike down those who speak your name or the name of your fathers until your Salka becomes as meaningless as infant babble. I will blot you out, hunt down your every trace. The track of your life has come to me, and it goes no further. I am your end, your utter obliteration.
Then torchlight and commotion flooded the darkness. His earlier cries had been heard. He saw bare and booted feet stamp in the mud, heard men curse and grunt. He watched his younger brother do a bare-chested pirouette into the mud, saw his last surviving cousin stumble to his knees, then topple like a drunk into a puddle.
I'm your chieftain!
Nayur bellowed.
Challenge me or witness my justice! Either way, justice will be done!
Curiously numb, Yersalka rolled his head through the muck, saw more and more Utamat gather about them. Torches sputtered and hissed in the rain, their orange light bleached white by sporadic flashes of lightning. He saw one of his wives, wrapped only in the bear pelt his father had given her, peering in horror at the spot where he lay. She stumbled toward him, her face vacant. Nayur struck her hard, as one might strike a man. She toppled from the pelt, fell motionless and naked at her chieftain's feet. She looked so cold.
This man, Nayur thundered, has betrayed his kinsmen on the field of battle. To free us,
Yersalka managed to cry.
To release the Utamot from your yoke, your depravity. You've heard his admission. His life and the lives of all his chattel are forfeit. No.
Yersalka coughed, but the numbness was reclaiming him. Where was the justice in this? He'd betrayed his chieftain, yes, but for honor. Nayor had betrayed his chieftain, his father, for the love of another man, for an outlander who could speak killing words. Where was the justice in this? Nayor extended his arms as though to grapple the thundering sky.
I am Nayor Uskiotha, breaker of horses and men, chieftain of the Utamot, and I have returned from the dead. Who dares dispute my judgment?
The rain continued to spiral down. Save for looks of awe and terror, none dared dispute the madman. Then a woman, the half-Norserai mongrel Nayur had taken wife, burst from the others and threw herself at him, weeping uncontrollably. She feebly beat at his chest, wailing something unintelligible. For a moment, Nayur held her tight. Then he sternly pressed her back.
It's me, Anissi, he said with shameful tenderness. I am whole.
Then he turned from her toward Yersalka, a demon by torchlight, an apparition by lightning strike. Yersalka's wives and children had gathered about their husband, wailing. Yersalka felt soft thighs beneath his head, the flutter of warm palms across his face and chest, but he could look only at the ravenous figure of his chieftain. He watched him catch his youngest daughter by the hair, snuff out her squeal with sharp iron. For a grisly moment, she remained fixed on his blade, and he shook her like a skewered doll. Yersalka's wives screamed and cowered. Looming above them, the chieftain of the Utamot hacked, again and again, until they groped and shuddered in the mud. Only Omiri, the lame daughter of Zunarit, whom Yersalka had married the previous spring, remained, weeping and clawing at her husband. Nayur seized her with his free hand, hoisted her by the back of the neck.
Her mouth worked like a fish about a soundless shriek.
Is this Zunorit's misbegotten count?
He snarled.
Yes,
Yursalka gasped. Nayur cast her like a rag to the mud.
She lives to watch our sport. Then she suffers the sins of her father.
Surrounded by his dead and dying family, Yursalka watched Nayur loop his bowel-like rope about scarred arms. He glimpsed the callous eyes of his tribesmen, knew they would do nothing. Not because they feared their lunatic chieftain, but because it was the way. Late autumn, 4111, year of the Tusk, Momim. Since Mathanet's declaration of holy war a year and a half earlier, untold thousands had gathered about Momim's walls. Among those well-placed within the thousand temples, there were rumors of the Shriah's dismay. He had not, it was said, anticipated such an overwhelming response to his summons. In particular, he had not thought so many lower caste men and women would take up the Tusk. Reports of freemen selling their wives and children into slavery so they might purchase passage to Momim were common. A widowed fuller from the city of Megiri, it was said, actually drowned his two sons rather than sell them to the slavers. When dragged before the local ecclesiastical magistrate, he allegedly claimed he was sending them ahead to Shima. Similar tales tarnished nearly every report sent to Sumna, so much so that they became more a matter of disgust than alarm for the Shrial apparati. What disturbed them were the stories, rare at first, of atrocities committed either by or against the men of the Tusk. Off the coast of Conraya, a small squall killed more than 900 low-caste pilgrims who'd been promised passage on unseaworthy ships. To the north, a cohort of Galioth freebooters wearing the Tusk destroyed no fewer than 17 villages over the course of their southward march. They left no witnesses and were discovered only when they attempted to sell the effects of Arnyalsa, a famed missionary priest, at market in Sumna. At Mathanet's direction, the Shrial knights encircled their encampment and killed them all. Then there was the story of Nreza Barasulis, the king of Sarange, and perhaps the wealthiest man in the Three Seas. When several thousand Tidoni who'd contracted his ships defaulted on their payment, he sent them to the island of Pharixis, an old pirate stronghold of King Raushang of Thunyeris, demanding they storm the island in lieu of monies owed. They did, and with abandon. Thousands of innocents perished, Enrithi innocents. Mathanet, it was said, wept at the news. He immediately placed all of House Nreza under Shrial censure, which voided all obligations, commercial or otherwise, to Barasulis, his sons, and his agents. The censure was quickly rescinded, however, once it became clear that the holy war would take months longer to assemble without Sarangi ships. Before the fiasco was concluded, Barasulis would actually win reparations in the form of Shrial trade concessions from the Thousand Temples. Rumor had it that the Nansur Emperor sent his personal congratulations to the canny Sarangi King. But none of these incidents provoked anything approaching the uproar caused by the march of what came to be called the Vulgar Holy War. When word reached Sumna that the first great names to arrive had capitulated to Aikuri Zarius III and signed his indenture, there was a great deal of concern that something untoward was about to happen. But without the luxury of sorcerers, Mathanet's entreaties, which extolled the virtues of patience and alluded darkly to the consequences of defiance, did not reach Momim until Kalmamunis, Tharshilka, Kumrezer, and the vast mobs that followed them were days gone. Mathanet was wroth. In ports around the Three Seas, the great state-sponsored contingents were finally preparing to embark. Gothjalk, the Earl of Agansinor, was already at sea with hundreds of Tidoni thanes and their households, more than 50,000 trained and disciplined men. The gathering of the Holy War, the Shrya's advisors estimated, was mere months from completion. All told, they said, the men of the Tusk would have numbered over 300,000, just enough to ensure the heathen's utter destruction. The premature march of those already gathered was an unmitigated disaster, even if they were largely rabble. Frantic messages were dispatched, imploring the lords to await the others, but Kalmamunis in particular was a stubborn man. When Gotian, the Grand Master of the Shrial Knights, intercepted him north of Gilgath with Maethanet's summons, the Palatine of Kanampuria allegedly said, "It's a sad thing when the Shrier himself doubts." Confusion and tragedy, rather than fanfare, had characterized the departure of the Vulgar Holy War from Momim. Since only a minority of those gathered were affiliated with one of the great names, the host possessed no clear leader, no organization at all, in effect. As a result, several riots broke out when the Nansor soldiery began distributing supplies, and anywhere from 400 to 500 of the faithful were killed. To his credit, Kalmamunis acted quickly, and with the assistance of Tharshilka's Galioth, his Conryans were able to impose order on the mobs. The Emperor's provisions were distributed with a modicum of fairness. What disputes remained were settled at sword point, and the Vulgar Holy War soon found itself prepared to march. The citizens of Momim swamped the city walls to watch the men of the Tusk depart. Many jeered at the pilgrims, who had long ago earned the contempt of their hosts. Most, however, remained silent, watching the endless fields of humanity trudge toward the southern horizon. They saw innumerable carts heaped with belongings, women and children walking dull-eyed through the dust, dogs prancing around countless feet, and endless thousands of impoverished low-caste men, hard-faced, but carrying only hammers, picks, or hoes. The Emperor himself watched the spectacle from the enameled heights of the southern gates. According to rumor, he was overheard remarking that the sight of so many hermits, beggars, and whores made him want to retch, but he'd already given the vulgar filth his dinner. Though the host could travel no more than 10 miles a day, the great names were generally satisfied with their progress. By sheer numbers alone, the Vulgar Holy War created mayhem along the coasts. Field slaves would notice strange men filing through the fields, an innocuous handful soon to be followed by thousands. Entire crops would be trampled, orchards and groves stripped. But with the Emperor's food in their bellies, the men of the Tusk were as disciplined as could be expected. The incidences of rape, murder, and robbery were infrequent enough that the great names could still dispense justice, and more important, still pretend they led an army. By the time they crossed into the frontier province of Ansirka, however, the pilgrims had turned to outright banditry. Companies of fanatics ranged the Ansirkan countryside, by and large restricting their depredations to harvests and livestock, but at times resorting to plunder and carnage. The town of Nabathra, famous for its wool markets, was sacked. When Nansor units under General Martimus, who had been instructed to shadow the Vulgar Holy War, attempted to restrain the men of the Tusk, several pitched battles broke out. At first, it seemed that the general, even though he had only 2 columns at his disposal, might bring the situation under control. But the weight of numbers and the ferocity of Tharshilka's Galioth forced him to retire north, and ultimately to shelter within Gilgath's walls. Kalmamunis issued a declaration blaming the Emperor, claiming Zorias III had issued edicts denying supplies to the men of the Tusk in direct contravention of his earlier oaths. In point of fact, however, the edicts had been issued by Maethanet, who had hoped this action might stall the horde's southward march and purchase enough time to convince them to return to Momim. With the men of the Tusk slowed by the need to forage, Maethanet issued further edicts, one rescinding the Shrial remission previously extended to all those who took up the Tusk, another punishing Kalmamunis, Tharshilka, and Kumrezer with Shrial censure, and a third threatening all those who continued under these great names with the same. This news, combined with the backlash against the bloodshed of the previous days, brought the Vulgar Holy War to a stop. For a time, even Tharshilka wavered in his resolve, and it seemed certain the core of the Vulgar Holy War, at least, would turn and begin marching back to Momim. But then Kalmamunis received news that an imperial supply train, apparently headed for the frontier fortress of Esgiliok, had miraculously fallen into the hands of his people. Convinced this was a sign from the god, He called together all the lords and impromptu leaders of the vulgar holy war and rallied them with inflammatory words. He asked them to pause and judge for themselves the righteousness of their endeavor. He reminded them that the Shraya was a man who, like all men, made errors in judgment from time to time.
"The ardor has been sapped from our blessed Shraya's heart," he said. "He's forgotten the sacred glory of what we do. But mark me, my brothers, when we storm the gates of Shaima, when we deliver the Padiraja's head in a sack, he will remember. He will praise us for remaining resolute when his heart faltered."
Though several thousand did defect and eventually filtered back to the imperial capital, the bulk of the vulgar holy war pressed on, now entirely immune to the exhortations of their Shraya. Bands of foragers scattered across the province, while the main body continued south, growing ever more fragmented. The villas of local caste nobles were looted. Numerous villages were put to the torch, the men massacred, the women raped. Walled towns that refused to open their gates were stormed. Eventually, the men of the Tusk found themselves beneath the Unaris Mountains, which for so long had been the southern bulwark for the cities of the Kirani Plain. Somehow, they were able to rally and reorganize beneath the walls of Askiliak, the ancient Kyrenian fortress the Nansur called the Breakers, for having stopped three previous Fainim invasions. For 2 days, the fortress gates remained shut against them. Then Prophilus, the commander of the imperial garrison, extended a dinner invitation to the great names and other caste nobles. Kalmamunus demanded hostages, and when he received them, he accepted the invitation. With Tharshilka, Kumrezer, and several lesser nobles, he entered Askiliak and was promptly taken captive. Prophilus produced a Shrial warrant and respectfully informed them that they would be held indefinitely unless they commanded the vulgar holy war to disband and return to Momim. When they refused, he tried reasoning with them, assuring them they had no hope of prevailing against the Kianin, who were, he insisted, as wily and as ruthless as the Skilvendi on the field of battle.
"Even if you marched at the head of a true army," he told them, "I would not throw the number sticks for you. As it stands, you lead a migration of women, children, and slavish men. I beg of you, relent."
Kalmamunus, however, replied with laughter. He admitted that sinew for sinew, weapon for weapon, the vulgar holy war was likely no match for the Padiraja's armies. But this, he claimed, was of no consequence, for surely the latter prophet had shown that frailty, when suffused with righteousness, was unconquerable.
"We have left Sunna and the Shraya behind us," he said. "With every step, we draw nearer Holy Shaima. With every step, we draw closer to paradise. Proceed with care, Prophilus, for as Inri Sejanus himself says, woe to he who obstructs the way."
Prophilus released Kalmamunus and the other great names before sunset. The following day, thousands upon thousands congregated in the valley beneath Asgiliok's turrets. A gentle rain washed over them. Hundreds of sacrificial fires were lit. The carcasses of the victims were piled high. Shakers covered their naked bodies in mud and howled their incomprehensible songs. Women sang gentle hymns, while their husbands sharpened whatever weapons, picks, scythes, old swords and maces, they'd been able to scavenge. Children chased dogs through the crowds. Many of the warriors among them, the Conryans, Galioth, and Aenoni, who'd marched with the great names, watched with dismay as a band of lepers climbed into the mountain passes, intent on being the first to set foot on heathen soil. The Unaris Mountains were not imposing, more a jumble of escarpments and bare stone slopes than a mountain range. But beyond them, drums called dusky, leopard-eyed men to worship Fane. Beyond them, Inrithi were gutted and hung from trees. For the faithful, the Unaris were the ends of the earth. The rain stopped. Lances of sunlight pierced the clouds. Singing hymns, blinking tears of joy from their eyes, the first men of the Tusk began filing into the mountains. Holy Shaima, it seemed to them, must lie just beyond the horizon. Always just beyond. When the news of the vulgar holy war's passage into heathen lands reached Sumna, Mathenet dismissed his court and retired to his chambers. His servants turned all petitioners away, informing them that the holy Shriya prayed and fasted and would do so until he learned the fate of the first wayward half of his holy war. Bowing as low as Jinan dictated, Skea said,
"The Emperor has asked that I brief you on the way to the Privy Chamber, Lord Exalt General. The Aenonai have arrived."
Confis looked up from his handwriting, dropped his quill and his inkhorn.
"Already? I said tomorrow." "An old trick, my lord. The Scarlet Spires is not above old tricks."
The Scarlet Spires. Confis nearly whistled at the thought. The mightiest school in the Three Seas, about to take up residency in the Holy War? Confis had always possessed a connoisseur's appreciation of life's larger inconsistencies. Absurdities such as this were like delicacies to him. The previous morning had revealed hundreds of foreign galleys and carracks moored in the mouth of the River Phaeus. The Scarlet Spires, the households of the King Regent, and more than a dozen Palatine governors, as well as legions of low-caste infantry, had been disembarking ever since. All High Aenon, it seemed, had come to join the Holy War. The Emperor was jubilant. Since the departure of the vulgar Holy War weeks earlier, more than 10,000 Thunieri under Prince Skeald, the son of the infamous King Raushang, and at least four times as many Taidoni under Gothyelk, the bellicose Earl of Agansinor, had arrived. Unfortunately, both men had proven immune to his uncle's charms, violently so. When presented with the indenture, Prince Skeald had ransacked the imperial court with those unnerving blue eyes of his, then wordlessly marched from the palace. Old Gothyelk had kicked over the lectern and called his uncle either a gelded heathen or a depraved faggot, depending on which translator one asked. The arrogance of barbarians, particularly Norserai barbarians, was unfathomable. But his uncle expected better of the Aenonai. They were Ketche, like the Nansur, and they were an old and mercantile people, like the Nansur. The Aenonai were civilized, despite their archaic devotion to their beards. Confis studied Skeas.
"You think they do this intentionally, to catch us off balance?"
He waved his parchment to dry in the air, then handed it to his dispatch, orders from Artemis to resume the patrols south of Momum.
"It's what I would do," Skeas replied frankly. "If one hoards enough petty advantages..."
Confis nodded. The Prime Council had paraphrased a famous passage from The Commerce of Souls, Agensis' classic philosophical treatise on politics. For a moment, Confis thought it strange that he and Skeas should despise each other so. In the absence of his uncle, they shared a peculiar understanding, as though, like the competitive sons of an abusive father, they could from time to time set aside their rivalry and acknowledge their shared lot with simple talk. He stood and looked down on the wizened man.
"Lead on, old father."
Caring nothing for the fine points of bureaucratic prestige, Confis had installed himself and his command on the lowest level of the Andiamine Heights, overlooking the Forum and the Squari campus. The hike to the Privy Chamber on the summit was a long one, and he idly wondered whether the old council was up to it. Over the years, more than one imperial apparati had died of the clutch, as the palace inhabitants called it. According to his grandmother, past emperors had actually used the climb to dispose of aging and quarrelsome functionaries, giving them messages allegedly too important to be trusted to slaves, then demanding their immediate return. The Andiamine Heights was no friend of soft hearts, literally or otherwise. Prompted more by curiosity than malice, Confis pressed the man to a brisk pace. He'd never seen anyone die of the clutch before. Remarkably, Skeas did not complain, and aside from swinging his arms like an old monkey, he showed no signs of strain. With easy wind, he began briefing Confis on the specifics of the treaty struck between the Scarlet Spires and the Thousand Temples, as far as they were known. When it seemed clear that Skeas had not just the appearance, but the stamina of an old monkey, Confis grew bored. After climbing several stairs, they passed through the Hapatine Gardens. As always, Confis glanced at the spot where Icuri and Ferris, his great-great-grandfather, had been assassinated more than a century before. The Endiamine Heights were filled with hundreds of such grottos, places where long-dead potentates had committed or suffered this or that scandalous act. His uncle, Confis knew, did his best to avoid such places, unless very drunk. For Zarius, the palace fairly hummed with memory of dead emperors. But for Confis, the Endiamine Heights was more a stage than a mausoleum. Even now, hidden choirs filled the galleries with hymns. At times, clouds of fragrant incense fogged the corridors and haloed the lanterns, so it seemed one climbed not to the summit of a hill, but to the very gates of heaven. Had he been a visitor rather than a resident, Confis knew, bare-chested slave girls would have served him heady wines laced with Nilnameshi narcotics. Pot-bellied eunuchs would have delivered gifts of scented oil and ceremonial weaponry. Everything would have been calculated to hoard petty advantages, as Scaeus might say, to distract, ingratiate, and overawe. Still unwinded, Scaeus continued regurgitating an apparently endless train of facts and admonitions. Confis listened with half an ear, waiting for the old fool to tell him something he didn't already know. Then the Prime Council turned to the topic of Eleazarus, the Grand Master of the Scarlet Spires.
Our agents in Carathusel say his formidable reputation scarcely does him justice. He was little more than a subdidact when his teacher, Sashioka, died of unknown causes some 10 years ago. Within 2 years, he was Grand Master of the greatest school in the Three Seas. That speaks of daunting intelligence and ability. You must—
And hunger, Confis interrupted.
No man achieves so much in so little time without hunger.
I suppose you would know.
Confis cackled.
Now that's the scarce I know and love. Surly, seething with illicit pride. You had me worried, old man.
The Prime Council continued as though he'd said nothing.
You must exercise great caution when you speak to him. Initially, your uncle thought to exclude you from this meeting. That is, until Eleazarus personally requested your presence.
My uncle what?
Even when bored, Confis possessed a keen ear for slights.
Excluded you. He feared the Grand Master would exploit your inexperience in these matters.
Exclude? Me?
Confis looked askance at the old man, for some reason reluctant to believe him. Was he playing some kind of game, fanning the fires of resentment? Perhaps this was another one of his uncle's tests.
But as I said, Scaeus continued, that's all changed, which is why I'm briefing you now.
I see, Confis replied skeptically. What was the old fool up to?
Tell me, Scaeus, what's the point of this meeting?
Point? I fear I don't understand, Lord Exalt General.
The purpose, the intent. What does my uncle hope to secure from Eleazarus and the Aenoni?
Scaeus frowned, as though the answer was so obvious that the question simply had to be a prelude to mockery.
The point is to secure Aenoni support for the indenture.
And if Eleazarus proves as intractable as, say, the Earl of Agansinor, what then?
With all due respect, my lord, I sincerely doubt.
If, Scaeus, what then?
Confis had been a field officer since the age of 15. If he wanted, he could make men jump with his tone. The old council cleared his throat. Scaeus, Confis knew, possessed administrative courage in excess, but he had no pluck whatsoever when it came to face-to-face confrontations. No wonder his uncle loved him so.
If Eleazarus spurns the indenture, the old man repeated, then the emperor denies him provisions, like the rest. And if the shrier demands my uncle supply them? By then the vulgar holy war will have been destroyed, or so we assume. Leadership, not provisions, will be Maethenet's primary concern. And who will that leader be?
Confis had spat each question hard on the heels of each answer, as an interrogator might. The old man was beginning to look rattled.
You, the Lion of Caiuth. And what will be my price?
The indenture that signed oath that all the provinces will be returned.
So I am the linchpin of my uncle's plans, am I not?
Yes, Lord Exalt-General.
So then tell me, dear old scarce, why would my uncle think to exclude me, from his negotiations with the Scarlet Spires?
The Prime Council's pace slackened. He looked to the florid whorls stitched across the rugs at their feet. Rather than speak, he wrung his hands. Confis grinned wolfishly.
You lied just now, didn't you, Scarce? The question of whether I should attend his meeting with Eleazaris never even arose. Did it?
When the man failed to respond, Confis seized him by the shoulders, glared at him.
Need I ask my uncle?
Scarce matched his eyes for a moment, then glanced down.
No, he said. There's no need.
Confis released his grip. With sweaty palms, he smoothed the front of the old man's silk robes.
What kind of game are you playing, Scarce? Did you think that by wounding my vanity, you could provoke me to act against my uncle, against my emperor? Are you trying to incite me to sedition?
The man looked positively panicked.
No, I'm an old fool, I know, but my days on this earth are numbered. I rejoice at the life the gods have given me. I rejoice at the sweet fruits I've eaten, for the great men I've known. And I know you'll find this difficult to believe. Exalt, because I've lived long enough to witness you grow in your glory. But this plan of your uncle's, to deliver a holy war to its destruction, a holy war, I fear for my soul, Icuri Confis, my soul.
Confis was dumbstruck, so much so he utterly forgot his anger. He'd assumed Scaeus's insinuations to be yet another of his uncle's probes and had responded accordingly. The possibility that the fool acted on his own had never occurred to him. For so many years, Scaeus and his uncle had seemed different incarnations of the same will.
By the gods, Scaeus, has Maethanet ensnared you as well?
The Prime Council shook his head.
No. I care nothing for Maethanet, or Shimer for that matter. You're young, you wouldn't understand my motives. The young can never see life for what it is, a knife's edge, as thin as the breaths that measure it. What gives it depth isn't memory. I've memories enough for 10 men, and yet my days are as thin and as shadowy as the greased linen the poor stretch over their windows. No, what gives life depth is the future. Without a future, without a horizon of promise or threat, our lives have no meaning. Only the future is real, Confis, and unless I make amends to the gods, I've no future left.
Confis snorted.
But I understand all too well, Scarce. You've spoken like a true Icuri. How does the poet Gergala put it? All love begins with one's own skin? Or soul, as the case may be. But then, I've always thought the two interchangeable. Do you understand? Can you?
He did understand, and better than Scaeus realized. His grandmother, Scaeus, conspired with his grandmother. He could even hear her voice.
You must bait both of them, Scaeus. Poison them against one another. Confis's infatuation with my son's madness will wane soon enough. Just you wait and see. He'll come running to us, and together we'll force Arias to abandon his mad plan.
He wondered whether the old drab had taken Scaeus as a lover. Likely, he concluded, and winced at the accompanying image. Like a prune fucking a twig, he thought.
You and my grandmother, he said. Hope to save the holy war from my uncle. A commendable undertaking, save that it verges on treachery. My grandmother, I can understand. She has him bewitched. But you, Scarce? You know, as few others do, what Icuri Zorias III is capable of once his suspicions are roused. A bit reckless, don't you think? Trying to pit me against him like this. But he listens to you, and more important, he needs you. Perhaps he does, but either way, it's immaterial. Your ancient stomachs may find his fare too undercooked,
but my uncle has laid out a feast, Scaeus, and I, for one, do not intend to gainsay it. No matter how much he despised his uncle, Confus had to admit that provisioning Calmamunus and the rabble that followed him was a move as brilliant as any he himself had made on the field of battle. The vulgar holy war would be annihilated by the heathen, and in a single stroke the empire would cow this Shrya, perhaps compel him to demand that the remaining men of the Tusk sign the imperial indenture and demonstrate to the Faenum that House Icuri bargained in good faith. The indenture would ensure the legality of any military action the empire might take against the men of the Tusk to retrieve her lost provinces, and the deal with the heathen would ensure that such military action would meet with little resistance when the time came. Such a plan, and devised not by Scaeus, but by his uncle. As much as that fact galled Confus, it must, he decided, gall the old council more.
"It's not the feast we dispute," Scaeus replied. "It's the price. Surely you can see this."
Confus studied the prime council for several long moments. There was something curiously pathetic, he thought, about the notion of the man plotting with his grandmother, like two beggars sneering at those too poor to give more than coppers.
"The empire. Restored?" he said coldly.
"I should think your soul a bargain, Scaeus." Scaeus opened his toothless mouth to retort, but then closed it. The emperor's privy chamber was an austere room, circular, ringed by black marble columns, with a surrounding gallery for those rare occasions, mostly ritual, when the houses of the congregate were invited to observe the emperor signing edicts into law. A small herd of ministers and slaves milled about the room's heart, clustered around the head of a mahogany table. Confus glimpsed his uncle's reflection floating beneath the table's polish, like a corpse in brackish water. There was no sign of the Scarlet Schoolman. The exalt general loitered near the entrance for several moments, studying the ivory plaques set into the walls, renditions of the great lawmakers of antiquity in the Tusk, from the prophet Angeshriel to the philosopher Porapharus. He wondered inanely which of his dead relatives the artisan had used to model their faces. The sound of his uncle's summons startled him.
"Come, we've only a few moments, nephew."
The others had withdrawn, leaving only Scaeus and Kemenketri at his uncle's side. The surrounding galleries, Confus could not help noticing, were filled with Eothic guardsmen and imperial sake. Confus took the seat his uncle indicated.
"Both Scaeus and Kemenketri agree,"
Zorias was saying,
"that Eleazaris is an infernally clever and dangerous man. How would you snare him, nephew?"
His uncle was trying to sound jocular, which meant he was afraid, as perhaps he should have been. No one yet knew why the Scarlet Spires had deigned to join the Holy War, and this meant no one knew the school's intent. For men like Skaelt and Gathjalk, the purpose was plain, redemption or conquest. But for Eleazaris, who could say what motivated any of the schools? Confus shrugged. "Snaring him is out of the question. One must know more than one's opponent to trap him, and as it stands, we know nothing. We know nothing of his deal with Maethanet. We don't even know why he would condescend to make such a deal, and to take such a risk. A school of his own volition joining a holy war. A holy war! In all honesty, Uncle, I'm not sure that securing his support for the indenture should even be our priority at this point."
"So what are you saying? That we should simply probe for details? I pay my spies good gold for such trifles, nephew."
"Trifles?" Confus struggled with his composure. Though his uncle's heart was too whorish for religious faith, he was as jealous of his ignorance as any zealot. If the facts contradicted his aspirations, they did not exist.
"You once asked me how I prevailed at Cayuth, Uncle. Do you remember what it was I told you?"
"Told me?" The emperor nearly spat. "You're always telling me things, Confus. How do you expect me to sort one impertinence from the other?"
This was perhaps the pettiest and most oft-used weapon in his uncle's arsenal, the threat to read counsel as commandment. The threat loomed over all their exchanges.
"You would presume to command the emperor?"
Confis graced his uncle with a conciliatory smile. From what Scare says, he said smoothly, I think we should simply bargain in good faith, as much as we can, anyway. We know too little to snare him. Stepping to the brink, then stepping back by pretending no such step had been taken, this had always been his family's way, at least until his grandmother's recent antics.
My thoughts precisely, Zariah said.
At least he still remembered the rules. Just then, a chamberlain announced the imminent arrival of Eleazarus and his retinue. Zarius bid Scaeus to tie his coray about his hand, which the old council did, while Kemenketri watched with distaste. This was something of a small dynastic tradition, adopted more than a century earlier and observed whenever members of the imperial family conferred with outside sorcerers. Kefra Muni, king regent and titular head of High Aenon, was announced first, but when the small Aenoni entourage filed into the chamber, he followed Eleazarus like a dog. The Grand Master's entrance was brisk and, Confis thought, anticlimactic. His demeanor was more that of a banker than a sorcerer, impatient of spectacle, hungry for the ledgers. He bowed to Zarius, but no lower than would the Shrya. A slave drew his chair back for him, and he sat effortlessly, despite his trailing crimson gowns. With rouged cheeks and reeking of perfume, Kefra Muni sat at his side, a chalky look of fear and resentment on his face. The obligatory exchange of honorifics, introductions, and compliments was observed. When Kemenketri, Eleazarus's counterpart in the imperial sake, was introduced, the Grand Master smiled disdainfully and shrugged, as though dubious of the man's station. Schoolmen, Confis had been told, were often insufferably haughty when in the company of other schoolmen. Kemenketri flushed in anger, but to his credit did not respond in kind. After these genanic preliminaries, the Grand Master turned to Confis. At long last, he said in fluent Shaic, I meet the famed Icuri Confis. Confis opened his mouth to reply, but his uncle spoke first.
He's a rarity, isn't he? Few rulers possess such instruments to execute their will. But surely you haven't come all this way just to meet my nephew.
Though Confis could not be certain, Eleazarus seemed to wink at him before turning to his uncle as though to say, We must suffer these fools patiently, mustn't we? Of course not, Eleazarus replied with damning brevity. Zarius seemed oblivious.
Then might I ask why the Scarlet Spires has joined the Holy War?
Eleazarus studied his unpainted fingernails.
Quite simple, really. We were purchased.
Purchased?
Indeed.
Most extraordinary transaction. What are the details of your arrangement?
The Grand Master smiled. Alas, I fear that secrecy is itself part of the arrangement. Unfortunately, I'm not able to divulge any of the details. Confis thought this an unlikely story. Not even the Thousand Temples was wealthy enough to hire the Scarlet Spires. They were here for reasons that transcended gold and Shrial trade concessions. Of that much he was certain. Changing directions as fluidly as a shark in water, the Grand Master continued, You worry, of course, about how our purposes bear upon your indenture. There was a sour pause. Then Zarius replied,
Of course.
His uncle chafed more than most at being premeditated by another. The Scarlet Spires, Eleazarus said demurely, cares nothing about who possesses the land conquered by the Holy War. Accordingly, Kefra Muni will sign your indenture gladly. Will you not, Kefra Muni? The painted man nodded but said nothing. The dog had been trained well. But, Eleazarus continued, there are several conditions we would see met first. Confis had predicted this. Civilized men haggle. Zarius protested.
Conditions? But for centuries, the lands from here to Nensophon have been...
I've heard all the arguments. Eleazarus interrupted. Dross. Pure dross. You and I both know what is truly at stake here, Emperor. Don't we? Zarius stared at him in dumb astonishment. He wasn't accustomed to interruptions, but then he wasn't accustomed to parleying with men who were more than his equals. High Aenon was a wealthy, densely populated nation. Of all the rulers and despots across the three seas, only the Padaraja of Kian possessed more commercial and military power than the Grand Master of the Scarlet Spires. If you don't, Eleazarus continued when Zarias failed to reply, then I'm sure your precocious nephew does. Young Confis? Do you know what's at stake here? Confis thought it obvious. Power, he said with a shrug. A strange fellowship, he realized, now existed between him and this sorcerer. From the outset, the Grand Master had accorded him the status of kindred intellect.
Even the foreigners know you're a fool, Uncle. Precisely, Confis, precisely. History is only a pretext for power, no? What matters?
The white-haired sorcerer trailed with a small grin, as though he'd stumbled upon a more effective tack with which to make his point.
Tell me, he asked Zarias, why did you provision Calmamunis, Cumreza, and the others? Why did you give them the means to march?
His uncle opted for the rehearsed reply.
To put an end to their depredations, why else?
Unlikely, Eleazarus snapped. I rather think that you provisioned the Vulgar Holy War in order to destroy it.
There was an uncomfortable pause.
But this is madness, Zarias finally replied. Damnation aside, what would we have to gain?
Gain? Eleazarus repeated with a wry grin. Why, the Holy War, of course. Our deal with Mathanet stripped you of whatever leverage you possessed with the Imperial sake, so you needed something else to barter. If the Vulgar Holy War is destroyed, then it will be far easier for you to convince Mathanet that the Holy War needs you, or, should I say, the now legendary military acumen of your nephew here. Your indenture will be his price, and the indenture effectively cedes to you all the proceeds of the Holy War. I must admit, it's a splendid plan.
This small flattery was Zarius's undoing. For a brief instant, his eyes flashed with jubilant conceit. Stupid men, Confis had found, tended to be excessively proud of their few brilliant moments. Eleazarus smiled.
He plays you, uncle, and you cannot even see.
The Grand Master leaned forward as though aware of the discomfort generated by his proximity. Eleazarus, Confis realized, was a master practitioner of Jinan.
As of yet, he said coldly, we don't know the specifics of the game you play, Emperor, but let me assure you of this. If it involves the betrayal of the Holy War, then it involves the betrayal of the Scarlet Spires. Do you know what this means, what it entails? If you betray us, Ikuri, then no one, he glanced darkly at Kemen Khetri, not even your Imperial sake, will be able to preserve you from our wrath. We are the Scarlet Spires, Emperor. Think on that.
You threaten me?
Zarias fairly gasped.
Assurances, Emperor. All arrangements require assurances.
Zarias yanked his face away, intent on Skaeus, who was fiercely whispering in his ear. Kemen Khetri, however, could contain himself no longer.
You overstep yourself, Eli. You act as though we sit in Carathuzel, when it's you who sit in Momem. Two of the three seas lie between you and your home, far too far to be uttering threats.
Eleazarus frowned, then snorted, turning to Confis as though the Grand Master of the Imperial sake did not exist.
In Carathuzel they call you the Lion of Kaiuth, he said nonchalantly.
His eyes were small, dark, and nimble. They scrutinized him from beneath bushy white brows.
Do they?
Confis asked, genuinely surprised that his grandmother's moniker had traveled so far so fast. Surprised and pleased. Very pleased.
My archivists tell me you're the first to defeat the Skilvendi in pitched battle. My spies, on the other hand, tell me your soldiers worship you as a god. Is this so?
Confis smiled, deciding the Grand Master would lick his ass as clean as a cat's if given the opportunity. For all his penetration, Eleazarus had misjudged him. It was time to set him straight.
What Kemen Khetri said just now is true, you know. No matter what your deal with Mathanet, you've delivered your school to its greatest peril since the Scholastic Wars.
and not just because of the Kisharim. You'll be a small enclave of profanity within a great tribe of fanatics. You'll need every friend you can get. For the first time, something like real anger surfaced in Eleazarus's eyes, like a glimpse of coals through a smoky fire. We can make the world burn with our song, young Confis. We need no one. Despite his uncle's gaffes, Confis left the negotiations confident that the House Icuri had secured far more than it had surrendered. For one, he was almost certain he knew why the Scarlet Spires had accepted Mathanet's offer to join the Holy War. Few things reveal a competitor's agenda more thoroughly than the process of negotiating a deal. Over the course of their haggling, it became obvious that the heart of Eleazarus's concern lay with the Kisharim. In exchange for Kephra Muni's signature on the indenture, he demanded that Kemenketri and the Imperial Sake surrender all the intelligence they'd amassed on the Phanum sorcerer priests over centuries of warring against them. Of course, this was to be expected. The Scarlet Spires had gambled its very existence on its ability to overcome the Kisharim. But there was an undeniable intensity in the way the Grand Master uttered their name. Eleazarus said, Kisharim, in the same manner Anansur would say, Skilvendi, the way one names an old and hated foe. For Confis, this could mean only one thing. The Scarlet Spires had been at war with the Kisharim long before Mathanet had declared the Holy War. Like House Icuri, the Scarlet Spires had embroiled itself in the Holy War in order to use it. For the Scarlet Spires, the Holy War was an instrument of revenge. When Confis mentioned his suspicions, his uncles sneered. Initially, at least. Eleazarus, he insisted, was too mercantile to risk so much for a trifle like vengeance. When Kemenketri and Skaeus also endorsed the theory, however, the Emperor realized he'd harbored the same suspicions all along. It was official. The Scarlet Spires had joined the Holy War to bring some pre-existing war with the Kisharim to conclusion. In itself, the conjecture was comforting. It meant the Scarlet Spires' agenda would not cross their own until the end, when it no longer mattered. It would be difficult for Eleazarus to make good on his threat once he and his school were dead. But what bothered Confis was the question of what had motivated Mathanet to call on the Scarlet Spires at all. Certainly, of all the schools, it was the most apt to destroy the Kisharim in an open confrontation. But on the face of it, Confis could think of no school more unlikely to join a holy war. As far as Confis knew, the Shrya had approached no other school, not even the Imperial Sake, which had been the traditional bulwark against the Kisharim through the jihads. Only the Scarlet Spires. Why? Unless Mathanet had somehow learned of their war. But this answer was even more troubling than the question. With nearly every Imperial spy in Sumna now dead, they had plenty of reasons to be wary of Mathanet's cunning as it was, but this? A Shrya who had penetrated the schools, and the Scarlet Spires, no less? For not the first time, Confis suspected that Mathanet, and not House Icuri, occupied the center of the Holy War's web. But he dared not share his misgivings with his uncle, who tended to be even more stupid when afraid. Instead, he explored this fear on his own. No longer did he gloat over future glories in the dark hours before sleep. Rather, he fretted over implications that he could neither stomach nor verify. Mathanet. What game did he play? For that matter, who was he? The news arrived days afterward. The vulgar Holy War had been annihilated. The reports were sketchy at first. Urgent messages from Asgiliok related the terrifying accounts of some dozen or so Galioth who had managed to escape across the Unaris Spur. The vulgar Holy War had been utterly overcome on the plains of Mengeta. Shortly afterward, two couriers arrived from Kian, the one bearing the severed heads of Kalmamunas, Tharshilka, and a man who may or may not have been Kumrezer. The other, bearing a secret message from Skaras himself, and delivered, as per the Sapatashah's instructions, to his former hostage and ward, Icuri Confis. It simply read, We cannot count the carcasses of your idolatrous kin, so many have been felled by the fury of our righteous hand. Praise be the solitary God. Know that House Icuri has been heard. After dismissing the courier, Confis spent several hours brooding over the message in his quarters. Again and again the words rose of their own volition. So many have been felled. We cannot count. Even though he was only 27 years of age, Icuri Confis had seen the carnage of many fields of war, enough that he could almost see the masses of Enrithi sprawled and tangled across the plains of Mengeta, their dead fish eyes staring into earth or across endless sky. But it wasn't guilt that moved his soul to ponder, and perhaps in a strange way even to grieve. It was the sheer scale of this first accomplished act. It was as though until now the dimensions of his uncle's plan had been too abstract for him to truly comprehend. Icuri Confis was in awe of what he and his uncle had done. House Icuri has been heard. The sacrifice of an entire army of men. Only the gods dared such acts. We have been heard. Many, Confis realized, would suspect it had been House Icuri that had spoken, but no one would know. A strange pride settled through him then, a secret pride, disconnected from the estimations of other men. In the annals of great events, there would be many accounts of this first tragic event of the Holy War. Responsibility for this catastrophe would be heaped upon Calmamunus and the other great names. In the ancestor lists of their descendants, they would be names of shame and scorn. There would be no mention of Icuri Confis. For an instant, Confis felt like a thief, the hidden author of a great loss. And the exhilaration he felt almost possessed a sexual intensity. He saw clearly now why he so loved this species of war. On the field of battle, his every act was open to the scrutiny of others. Here, however, he stood outside scrutiny, enacted destiny from a place that transcended judgment or recrimination. He lay hidden in the womb of events, like a god.